Je suis très heureux d'accueillir aujourd'hui Mathieu Botvinnik. Mathieu Botvinnik, you are MD and PhD. You are one of this generation of psychiatrists who make fundamental contributions to cognitive science and computational neuroscience. So very impressive, but we know a few, including Carl Friston, for instance, and a few others. So you were trained in Carnegie Mellon, where you got your PhD. And then you became a professor in Princeton, where you were until recently. But now you are both at UCL in London and also with the group of Google DeepMind. And I think this is a quite interesting situation where we have this company, Google DeepMind, who is recruiting some of the best cognitive scientists and neuroscientists to try to model the brain and to inform computational neuroscience, computational sciences with discoveries from neuroscience and vice versa. So thank you very much for sharing your knowledge with us today. And you're going to talk about meta-reinforcement learning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's my honor to be here. I appreciate the invitation. I understand it's an audience with diverse backgrounds, but that the usual model here is to start with comments that will be accessible to everyone, but then to move in later phases of the talk into more specialized comments. So I'll try to kind of bridge the gap, but I apologize ahead of time if some of the talk ends up being a bit technical, since that's where the material originally came from, that kind of that kind of perspective. Before I start, I just want to comment on what fun it is to be here at the Collège de France, because actually my first publication in cognitive science was inspired by Maurice Merleau-Ponty. Some of you may have heard of this thing called the rubber hand illusion, which is something that I worked on my very first year in graduate school. And I had the idea for this this work while I was reading Merleau-Ponty. So it's very nice, you know, very nice to be on his turf here. I also, in sort of looking into what this place is about, I was very pleased to see this phrase in the source that I, probably there's a better source for information about Collège de France, but Wikipedia is the go-to, and it makes this comment about science in the making. So this is relevant to the comments I want to make today, because in fact, this is very much science in the making. In fact, this is only, I think, the second time that I've presented this work, and it's really kind of hot off the presses, stuff that we're just very, very actively working out now. And so I hope that makes it more fun to listen to rather than listening to kind of a standard stump speech. But also it gives me an opportunity to apologize for any lack of polish that this presentation may have, since I haven't had many run-throughs to get this to get the patter tuned. In any case, so what am I here to talk about? I know that title is a bit cryptic. What I want to talk about is learning. And in particular, how humans and other animals learn from reward and punishment. I'm going to use a term throughout this presentation, reinforcement learning, which is simply a fancy term for what I just said, how the brain learns from reward and punishment to do things that, in the long term, will maximize the chance of reward and minimize the chance of punishment. So this is from a famous book by Sutton and Bartow, and they define reinforcement learning as learning what to do, how to map situations to actions so as to maximize a numerical reward signal. The learner is not told which actions to take, but instead must discover which actions yield the most reward by trying them. There is a, needless to say, a great deal of research, spanning centuries, really, on how the brain uses reward and punishment experiences to adjust behavior. Over the past 20 years or so, a number of pioneering, really ingenious studies have led to what might be called a standard model of reward-based learning in the brain. So let me introduce that to you. Those of you who are in neuroscience or psychology will recognize this story immediately. It centers on a neurotransmitter, a chemical in the brain called dopamine, which is generated in nuclei in the, let me see if I can make sure I'm going to push the right button here, is generated in nuclei deep in the brain stem, and is kind of distributed, squirted quite broadly into areas of the cortex, in particular the frontal cortex, and also deeper structures, the basal ganglia, And the idea that is now quite prevalent, and I think well established empirically, is that this chemical dopamine signals what's called a reward prediction error. This is a construct from a computational area of research on reinforcement learning. And so let me just let me introduce you to this notion of a reward prediction error, because it's going to play a pretty central role in what we're going to talk about going forward. So this is a very famous diagram from work by Wolfram Schultz showing, so time is on the x-axis here, and if you pay attention to what's going on up here, these peaks show a momentary burst of dopamine release. And in the top figure, what you're seeing is what happens when a monkey is given an unexpected reward, a squirt of juice into its mouth. Dopamine, there's a momentary burst in the release of dopamine. So it seems to have something to do with reward. But it's not just reward. Here's a different situation where the monkey gets a reward, but it's learned through experience that that reward is very reliably predicted by a condition stimulus, a tone. And in this situation, when the monkey hears the tone, that burst of dopamine occurs. When the reward occurs, actually, there's no burst of dopamine. So the dopamine burst seems to occur in association with something that predicts reward, not with reward itself. When reward is not surprising, dopamine doesn't really care. In fact, if a conditioned stimulus occurs, dopamine gets excited, but then the predicted reward fails to occur, there's a dip in dopamine. So based on observations like this, the idea has emerged that dopamine may be signaling a reward prediction error. There's a burst of dopamine when things go better than you expected, and a dip in dopamine when things go worse than expected. Why is this a good learning signal? Well, the idea, again, through dozens and dozens of very important studies, really, has emerged that this burst of dopamine, when it reaches the striatum, these deep structures, it adjusts the strength of synaptic connections. And the role of that in driving behavior is that you have a percept or a situation, and an action is executed. And if reward occurs, if an unexpected reward occurs, then you should strengthen the association between that situation and that action. So the intuition is, if I'm pleasantly surprised, if I do something and then I'm pleasantly surprised by the outcome, I should probably do that thing more often in the future. If I do something and I'm unpleasantly surprised, then I should probably do that thing less often in the future. So the idea that's emerged is that dopamine signals a reward prediction error, telling me whether things went better than I expected or less well than I expected. And that leads to a strengthening or weakening of stimulus-response associations, so that behavior moves in the direction of reward. This is what I'll refer to as the standard model. And as I said, it's a centerpiece of the field, and it's very well validated empirically. However, even as evidence has accrued in favor of this theory, a number of observations have cropped up that seem problematic. They seem to present difficulty for this standard model. One has to do with this large area of the brain called the prefrontal cortex and its subcortical, its deeper associated structures. Why is there a problem here? Well, if we look at what happens in a study where a monkey is presented with two choices, A and B, and it can choose one by just looking at it, and then it gets reward, one side or the other, it either gets a juice reward or it doesn't, and it learns through experience, through reinforcement learning, which of these targets is going to be more reliably rewarded. If we put a monkey in a situation like that, and then we record activity, neural activity, spiking activity, action potentials, in neurons in the prefrontal cortex, we find that there are neurons that respond to, they seem to represent the choice that the monkey makes, but there are neurons that represent a whole bunch of other things. They represent the value of each of those two visual options, and critically, they also represent the history of recent choices and recent reward outcomes. These are neural activities. These are action potentials that are coding for these quantities. Why is this awkward for the standard theory? Well, what we're seeing here really is consistent with the idea that the prefrontal cortex is doing reinforcement learning on its own. It's encoding previous actions, previous outcomes. It's using that to encode the value of actions going forward, and it's using those value representations to drive actions. That's what I just described as reinforcement learning. But here it's happening in a completely different way from the dopamine story that I told before. There are no synaptic weights being changed here. There are no, there's not necessarily any dopamine involved in this. These are just neurons in the prefrontal cortex representing relevant quantities. So once this is just an example study, but there are actually a cluster of studies like this that suggest that the prefrontal cortex is doing reinforcement learning in its activities, in its dynamics. So now, once we take this on board, now we have two reinforcement learning systems. We have dopamine, which is driving synaptic change, and then we have the prefrontal cortex, which seems to be doing reinforcement learning, reward-based learning in its activities. Why would there be two systems that are doing this thing? Why this redundancy? One idea that's emerged is that the systems are doing different kinds of reinforcement learning. The dopamine system is doing something called model-free reinforcement learning, and the prefrontal cortex is doing something called model-based reinforcement learning. The one way of describing the difference between those is that model-based reinforcement learning is based on a model of the task. It's based on an internal representation of task contingencies. If I do this, then this will happen. If I do that, then I'll get this reward. Whereas model-free doesn't need that. It just relies on strengthening and weakening of stimulus-response associations. So there's a lot of evidence that favors this kind of dual system account. However, here again, there are some awkward findings. For example, if the dopamine learning mechanism were model-free, it shouldn't reflect something called inferred value, which I'll explain now. But it does. And I'll put some meat on those bones. So here's another very simple task. We have a monkey that looks at a central fixation point, and then it sees either a left target or a right target. And it saccades, it makes a visual, it moves its eyes toward the target that appears. And then it's either given a juice reward or it's not, depending on which side it was asked to look toward. So sometimes the left target is rewarded, and other times the right is rewarded. And these reward contingencies stay stable for a while, and then they reverse. They reverse in a way that's not signaled to the animal, except through the outcomes themselves. So the animal will be going along, left is rewarded, left is rewarded, left is rewarded, and then all of a sudden, without any warning, right will be rewarded, and then that will continue for a while. So what do we see at the level of dopamine? Well, let's look at a moment just before the animal gets experiences an outcome that indicates a reversal. So let's say that left has been rewarded for a while, and the animal's kind of gotten used to this. But then a right target appears. Now, the animal hasn't gotten any reward yet, or it hasn't experienced a lack of reward, so it has every reason to believe that the same old contingencies exist. So I'm not sure what I just said, but let me set up the scenario again. Let's imagine that the animal has been rewarded for left. I think I said we're going to switch to right, but scratch that. It's been rewarded for left, and it sees left. What's going to happen? Well, dopamine's going to get excited. Hey, left is rewarded. Here's a left. I can expect juice after this. And if it sees a right, then dopamine isn't excited. You don't get that dopamine response. But now, let's imagine again that we're at a moment where a reversal is about to occur. So right after this occurs, right after the animal sees the cue and its dopamine activity shows this temporal profile, right after that, it gets the news that a reversal has occurred. So let's say the target that it thought was going to be rewarded, suddenly it finds out, oh, it's not rewarded. What happens then if that same target is presented on the next trial? Well, if the animal understands the task, then the target that used to be rewarded should not trigger a dopamine response anymore because the animal knows. It's experienced that it has evidence to say that there's been a reversal. So the target that excited its dopamine system one trial ago now disappoints the dopamine system. Okay, and the target that wouldn't have excited the dopamine system now does. That's interesting. It's nice. It's consistent with everything I've said so far because the animal has experienced a stimulus-reward association, and then the dopamine system is adjusting to that. But consider a different scenario now. The animal has been rewarded for left. Then it finds out, oops, left is no longer rewarded. And then on the next trial, it gets the right target. So it has no experience with the right in this new regime, right? It hasn't experienced the right target since the reversal. But what you find is that if the right was not rewarded before, and it can infer that the right target should be rewarded now, the dopamine system gets excited when it sees the right target, even though it hasn't experienced yet directly that the right target is rewarded. It's inferring that because since I know there's been a reversal, now I can tell that that other target should be rewarded. This is model-based inference. This draws on a knowledge of the task. It's a simple task, but there's knowledge there, and that's significant. So this is awkward for the standard theory of dopamine, because dopamine is supposed to be part of a model-free learning mechanism. It's not supposed to be this clever. There are richer and more interesting contexts in which model-based inference has been studied. Those of you who are in the business may recognize the two-step task that was introduced by Nathaniel Daw. The idea here is that you start in some state that's indicated by, you know, perceptual stimuli on the screen, and you select between two actions, one and two. And action one tends to transition you to a particular step two state, and action two will tend to transition you to some other step two state. And these are associated with their own reward probabilities, which change over time. And so as a subject in this experiment, you kind of have to keep track of what's rewarded and what's not. You have to learn, in other words. But each of these actions also has a smaller probability of going the other direction. So why is this a good setup? Well, consider what happens if somebody chooses action one and then experiences one of these uncommon transitions, ends up over here in this state, and then, hey, gets a reward. What should happen now when that subject is put back up in the beginning and starts the next trial? Well, a model-free learning system is going to say, hey, I executed action one and I was rewarded. I should execute action one again. Action one was good. It was reinforced. But a model-based system is going to take into account the structure of the task and is going to say, oh, well, I executed action one, but then I made this very unusual transition and ended up over here, and that was good. So if I'm smart when I'm back up here, I won't select action one again. I'll select action two because I want to get here, and action two is the best way to do that. So this simple task, and this is the reason it was created and the reason that it's become popular in research, gives us a way of teasing apart action, model-free and model-based action selection. Without getting into the details, if you plot behavior at the beginning of the trial based on the outcome on the previous trial and whether it followed a common or uncommon transition and whether it was rewarded or unrewarded, you get this plot that clearly differentiates in terms of its overall pattern between model-free reinforcement learning and model-based reinforcement learning. We'll return to this. This shows a strong interaction between whether it was an uncommon or a common transition and whether it was rewarded or not. And so this is kind of the fingerprint here of model-based control. And in human studies and even more starkly in animal studies, this is the pattern that we see. This is from a recent study that I was involved with out of Carlos Brody's lab with rats. Very strongly based model, very strongly model-based pattern of behavior. I said before that the awkward thing in this part of the literature is that dopamine signals look model-based, right? I haven't talked here yet about dopamine signals, but you can take a human subject performing this task, put them in the fMRI scanner, and look what's going on in the basal ganglia, where you can detect these dopamine-based signals. And you can compare the signals that you see against what you would expect from a model-free system and what you would expect from a model-based system. And in a very influential finding, Nathaniel Daw and Ray Dolan and colleagues found that targets for dopamine in the basal ganglia seemed to carry a model-based prediction error signal. Again, a bit awkward for the standard theory where dopamine is supposed to drive model-free reinforcement learning. And this is an awkwardness that has been openly acknowledged by the very people who have promulgated this dual system theory. So where does this leave us? We have the standard model of dopamine. We have this idea that the prefrontal cortex is involved in model-based reinforcement learning. But there are these riddles, these kind of inconsistencies, these puzzles that seem to challenge or destabilize these otherwise very successful theories. So I'm going to talk to you now about work that we've been doing, computational work, which takes a new perspective on reward-based decision making, and in the end puts in place a new theory that preserves these original ideas. So I'm not going to say anything that really seeks to overthrow this standard model of dopamine or the idea that the prefrontal cortex is involved in model-based control. But what I'm going to try to do is place these ideas in a larger context where we preserve an understanding of the observations that led to these theories in the first place, but also we resolve some of these mysteries. And at the same time, the theory that I'm going to put forward has another appealing aspect, which is that it explains a whole range of phenomena that used to, in the past, have received very different kind of special purpose explanations and suggests how they might all arise from a single mechanism. So it has this advantage of parsimony. Okay, so let's get into this. This framework that I'm going to put forward rests on three key assumptions. The assumptions are not new. The assumptions are fairly conventional. There's a lot of evidence to support each of them. But the structure of the argument here will be, once you put these three assumptions in place at the same time, you get almost automatically an emergent effect, which nobody seems to have noticed so far, and that's going to be the focus of the talk going forward. But what are these assumptions? The first assumption is that the prefrontal cortex circuit, and I'll define that in a minute, can be thought of legitimately as a recurrent neural network. So by prefrontal circuit here, I mean the prefrontal cortex, which we were talking about earlier, but also its subcortical affiliates. So those of you who know something about neuroanatomy will know that each part of the cortex is associated with a sector of the basal ganglia, and in turn with a sector of the thalamus, forming these kinds of loops. And so from now on, when I say prefrontal network or prefrontal circuit, I will mean prefrontal cortex, but also the caudate nucleus, for example, and the mediodorsal thalamus, these subcortical regions with which it's affiliated. By recurrent neural network, I just mean a network of neurons, and in the models that I'll be discussing, neuron-like processing elements, that has loops where the synaptic connections allow activity to flow through a closed circuit so that the system is endowed with memory. It can keep information around over time. That's all recurrent means. Okay, so number one, prefrontal circuit is a recurrent neural network. I'm putting citations in here. I could have put many, many more. There's lots of work adopting this assumption. The second assumption is essentially the standard theory of dopamine. We're going to assume that synaptic weights within the prefrontal cortex circuit are adjusted through model-free dopamine-driven reinforcement learning. That could happen at the level of the basal ganglia. We can speculate that it might also happen in the prefrontal cortex itself. It doesn't really matter. The main assumption here is that dopamine-driven reinforcement learning adjusts the synaptic weights that govern how the prefrontal cortex circuit operates. And the third assumption, it has to do with the task environment. So often in studies of reinforcement learning, the experimental will put in place a single task. The animal, the human subject, is given a single task to learn that involves fixed rewards and punishments, and the subject has to figure those out and adjust its behavior. But we're going to make a richer assumption, which is that the brain learns in an environment that doesn't just involve one reinforcement learning problem, but involves a whole series of reinforcement learning problems. So in the tasks that we'll look at, you can think of this as, you know, there's some environment that has an underlying set of parameters, and this environment is kind of generating or spitting out reinforcement learning problems. And each reinforcement learning problem is a little different, but they all share structure. To give you an intuitive example, think of your home. Your home stays the same from day to day, but the goals that you're pursuing in your home change. Am I looking for my keys? Am I looking for a fork? Am I headed toward the laundry? These are different reward functions, right? These have different measures of success And your reinforcement learning problem is constantly changing in that way. So this is not the usual assumption in experiments that focus on reinforcement learning, but I hope you'll agree with me that this is a rather benign assumption about real life, about the environment that we actually inhabit. Okay. So the main thesis of my talk is that if you adopt these three assumptions, then a whole slew of interesting things follow. And they all grow out of an emergent computational effect that I'm going to call meta-reinforcement learning. What is this? So the idea is that when those three conditions are satisfied, what results is an effect whereby the prefrontal cortex circuit, this recurrent neural network, learns its own autonomous reinforcement learning procedure, which is distinct from the reinforcement learning algorithm that was used to set the network weights. Remember, that was supposed to be dopamine-driven, model-free reinforcement learning. This is the effect we're going to call meta-reinforcement learning, and I'm going to illustrate it in gory detail going forward. Couple points to keep in mind, though. This learned reinforcement learning procedure is implemented in the prefrontal cortex dynamics, that is to say, the pattern of activity over time that arises from the recurrent connectivity of the prefrontal cortex. And it can therefore execute, this learning procedure can execute, even when the synaptic weights are frozen. Now, this wouldn't happen in a biological system without an experimenter intervening, but in order to convey what's going on here clearly, in a lot of the simulations I'm about to summarize, we, after training the weights in the system, we'll hold them frozen. We'll hold the synaptic weights or synaptic efficacies constant. And we'll still see that the system learns. And the point there is to emphasize that the learning that we're seeing is not being driven by dopamine-based synaptic change, but instead is happening in the recurrent dynamics, in the activity dynamics of the prefrontal cortex. But those dynamics were learned through those synaptic changes. Okay, another thing to keep in mind as we illustrate this principle is that this learned reinforcement learning procedure can and typically will differ from the reinforcement learning algorithm that trained the weights in the system. It can have different hyperparameters. I'll give an example of that in a minute. It can be model-based, even though the original RL algorithm was model-free, and it can differ arbitrarily in other ways. And critically, it not only differs in general, but it'll differ in a way that adapts it to the task environment. So this learned RL procedure that emerges in the prefrontal cortex will be sculpted by the task environment, and it therefore will exploit consistent task structure, allowing the system to learn faster. So this is why we call it meta-learning, meta-reinforcement learning. Okay, good. So now we have the ideas in place. For the rest of the time that I have, I want to summarize for you a set of five computational simulations that we've done in order to illustrate this effect. And each one is going to address a particular study from the neuroscience literature. And we've chosen these because each of the studies that we'll concentrate on illustrates some key aspect of meta-reinforcement learning. You'll see that the phenomena that we'll treat are quite diverse, but that's a way of showcasing the range of phenomena that this theory can account for. The other basis on which we chose the phenomena in question, as you'll see, is that some of them relate to these puzzles or riddles that we started with. All right. So just to say a word about the model that will be employed here, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. If anybody has questions about the implementational nuts and bolts, please see me afterward. We have a paper on this now, which I can send you to. It's quite simple. We're just going to take a recurrent neural network. So this is meant to summarize that there's a set of neuron-like elements here. The number varied from simulation to simulation, but usually somewhere between 50 and 150. And this circular arrow just means that they're recurrently connected. There are loops of activity loops of connectivity. The inputs are a perceptual observation, and then also critically, the action that was performed on the previous time step and the reward that was received on the previous time step. The outputs are an action and also an estimate of the state value. How good is this situation that I'm in right now? Those of you familiar with actor-critic architectures and reinforcement learning will recognize this sort of dual output. And of course, this is needed for a system that is going to compute reward prediction errors. How can I be surprised if I didn't have an expectation? This symbol here stands for the reward prediction error, and the fact that this arrow goes through the recurrent network simply means that the reward prediction error is training the weights in this system. And again, if people are interested in talking about the algorithm that we use, I'm happy to do that later. Okay, so very simple. I'm ignoring vast amounts of detail having to do with prefrontal anatomy and so forth, just to focus on the computational essentials. Okay, but some interesting things happen even with this simple setup. So let's start with this study from Wolfram Schultz's lab that I described earlier as presenting a bit of a difficulty for the standard model of dopamine-based reinforcement learning. Again, an animal looks at a central target and then chooses between two peripheral visual targets. After it's chosen one, waits for a second, it either gets a reward or it doesn't. Now, I didn't emphasize this before, but a critical aspect of this task is that it changes from trial block to trial block, from session to session. The probability of reward for looking at the left thing and the probability of reward for looking at the right thing, those probabilities vary from session to session. So the animal constantly has to be learning. Every time it gets into a new session, it has to say, okay, well, let's see. How's the left one paying off? How's the right one paying off? Let me explore here. Let me try things out. And as I gather evidence or data, I will kind of solidify my policy, my way of dealing with the current situation. Given the details of this task, the optimal policy is something called probability matching, whereby the animal will allocate behavior to one of the two targets, to each of the two targets, in proportion to the amount of reward that it's getting for that target. So as the difference in expected value for target A and target B grows, so does the determinism of behavior. Let me see what the animation is here. Right. So as target B becomes more and more reliable in its payoffs relative to target A, as target A gets more and more reliable, more of the animal's choices will be toward target A. And the fact that this is a diagonal rather than a step function indicates this thing called probability matching. Okay. But the reason I spoke about this task before was because of what the experimenters found in the prefrontal cortex when they recorded activity in prefrontal neurons. And as you'll recall, they found neurons that coded for the choice, they found neurons that coded for the value of the two options, they found neurons that coded for the recent history of actions and outcomes. So we simulated this task by taking that neural network that I diagrammed in the last figure and we simply trained it using model-free reinforcement learning on this task. The payoff contingencies changed from block to block, just as in the Schultz task, and so the network had to explore and then transition to exploitation. And without any additional assumptions, we found that the network adjusted its behavior to the current reward contingencies in essentially exactly the same way that the monkeys did, even for reward contingencies that were held out during training. So this shows that the network generalized gracefully to new situations. And then beyond that, when we looked at the units, the artificial neurons in that recurrent network, and evaluated what information they were coding for, we found neurons that coded for all of these quantities that Schultz and colleagues found in prefrontal cortex. Neurons that coded for the value of the two items, neurons that coded for the current choice that the system was about to make, and then critically, neurons that coded for the history of actions and outcomes. Now, this is in a way a trivial result given our setup. Why? Because remember, after the system was trained on this task and we transitioned to testing it, we held the synaptic weights in the system constant. So the system learned, right? It adjusted its behavior within a session to the payoff contingencies, but it was doing that without any synaptic change. It was doing that purely in its activation dynamics. There's only one way to do that, which is to hold information about past actions and past outcomes in your unit activities, rather than in the synaptic weights. So it's, as I say, almost trivial that we find this, this information when we look inside the prefrontal cortex network. But it's an illustration of this meta-reinforcement learning effect in action. So recall, the dynamics of the system that are coding for these properties and giving rise to this behavior, where do those dynamics come from? Well, they come from the synaptic weights that define the dynamics of this recurrent network. Where do those synaptic weights come from? They come from dopamine-driven synaptic change. So we have one learning algorithm, the dopamine-based algorithm, giving rise to another one, which is implemented in the activation dynamics of the prefrontal cortex. And that second learning algorithm becomes autonomous. Once it's in place, it no longer needs dopamine. Okay, there are going to be a few slides I'm going to skip past, but I just want to refer to the fact that we did much more detailed analyses of the behavior of the network and found that it emergently gave rise to patterns that were actually quite strikingly similar to detailed patterns of behavior in matching studies with animals. Okay, but let's move on to the second simulation. Now hopefully you've got the basic idea. One learning algorithm based on dopamine and synaptic change gives rise to another, which is implemented in the activation dynamics of prefrontal cortex. And that latter algorithm is autonomous. Okay, let's dig deeper. So I said before that that learned algorithm is not only autonomous once it's in place, but it's also different. It's not necessarily the same learning algorithm that, you know, that engendered it. So let's look at a demonstration of this, which also has some other interesting aspects. So in this simulation, we're going to show that the learning rate of this emergent learning algorithm can be different from the learning rate of the original one. What's the learning rate? Well, it's the speed with which you update your behavior based on rewards and punishments. Tim Behrens and colleagues at Oxford did a very brilliant study back in 2007 where they looked at learning rates in a reward-based decision-making task. But there was a twist, which was that the task went through phases that were where the reward probabilities were quite stable over time, and then other phases where the reward probabilities changed quite rapidly. And in this situation, it makes sense to adjust your learning rate. If things are changing very rapidly, it makes sense to update your behavior quickly, to have a high learning rate. If things are quite stable, then it makes sense to have a small learning rate so that you don't get thrown off by outlier outcomes. And in fact, Tim and his colleagues found that, indeed, during these stable periods, if you looked at human behavior, the learning rates were smaller. And during the volatile periods, they were higher. So this is just a summary of that effect. During stable blocks here and here, the learning rate was lower than volatile blocks here and here. So we took Tim's task, and we trained our simple recurrent neural network on the same thing. It dealt with this decision-making task from session to session during training in a way where sometimes it dealt with a volatile environment, sometimes it dealt with a stable environment. And the only way it could know was by just observing the reward outcomes. And then at test, again, with the weights frozen, we found that the learning rates that the system reflected in its behavior showed the same overall profile. So when the world is unstable and volatile, the system showed a higher learning rate. Okay, so this is neat in itself because we have a recurrent neural network that is adjusting its learning rate as the environment changes, but it also serves to illustrate the more fundamental point that the learned learning procedure in prefrontal cortex here has different properties from the original one. Because the learning rate that we used for the model-free dopamine-based learning algorithm that trained up the recurrent neural network was something like 0.0007. So it wouldn't even show up on this plot. It's somewhere down by the floor here. The learning algorithm that's being implemented in the prefrontal dynamics in this model is just a different learning algorithm. It's not the same in any way as the one that gave rise to it. Another detail is from the Behrens study is that they used fMRI and showed that there were portions of the prefrontal cortex, in particular the anterior cingulate cortex, where activity tracked the degree of volatility in the task, and by the same token, the learning rate. And we found that in our recurrent neural network, there was a significant proportion of units whose activity tracked the volatility of the task or the learning rate of the system. This is just another illustration. This is from a Bayesian model that Tim built, showing that as the volatility, so here the volatile session is on the left rather than the right, the learning rates are higher here in an optimal observer model, and when things get stable, they trail off. And this is behavior from our recurrent neural network, which looks very similar. Okay. So, good. So now now that we've kind of got the fundamentals in place here, let's go back to reward prediction errors. So I said that one of the awkward things in the literature for the standard model of dopamine is that these reward prediction error signals that you see either when you look at dopamine directly or look at fMRI data that seems to indicate what's going on in the dopamine system, they're too clever. They're too smart. They seem to be model-based. The surprise signals seem to draw in information about the structure of the task. That's not what people had in mind with the original dopamine story. So how can we understand this? Well, it turns out that this meta-reinforcement learning framework gives rise to this kind of effect, essentially automatically. So let's go back to this experiment by Bromberg, Martin, and colleagues. Central fixation, then a peripheral target left or right occurs, the animal has to make a visual saccade to that target, and then in some blocks it's rewarded on the left and not on the right, and other blocks it's the reverse, but it doesn't know when these reversals are going to occur, and it has to infer that from the outcomes. And critically, dopamine shows this inferred value effect, which seems to indicate that the dopamine system has some access to knowledge about the structure of the task. So we took our simple recurrent neural network, trained it with model-free reinforcement learning, and then looked at the reward prediction error signals that that it generated after a significant amount of experience with this task. And we see exactly the same effect. Before a reversal, the RPE signal is excited about based on what was going on in the previous block, because it doesn't know a reversal has happened yet. After a reversal, when you present the same stimulus again, the reward prediction errors flip, indicating that the system has, you know, understood that there's been a reversal. But then, most significantly, the reward prediction error signals also flip for the target that hasn't yet been presented since the reversal, indicating that experience with one target, indicating that a reversal has occurred, informs reward prediction errors for the other one, model-based or inferred value. So this is smaller than this in this bit of empirical data. We don't see that in our model. We could probably tweak our model to make the environment a little less deterministic and get that same effect, but we didn't undertake that because if you look deeper into the study, you don't always see this kind of asymmetry. In some other animals and some other slightly different conditions, they didn't see this difference in size. So it's not something that we're worried about. Okay. Why? Why do we get this effect? Well, the answer is actually quite simple. This is the equation for the reward prediction error signal. And the only important thing to take away here is that the reward prediction error is based on reward that you experienced, but also the things that you were expecting. So you're not going to be surprised unless you have expectations going in, right? Just by definition. And the expectation is encoded in this thing called a state value. And I said before that that expectation signal, we assume, is one of the outputs of this prefrontal cortex network. So during training, the dynamics of the prefrontal cortex network learn about the temporal dynamics of the task. The system is recurrent, it has memory, and so it can learn about reversals, it can learn about the implications of what happened on the previous trial, and these inevitably show up not only in its actions, but in its state values. And these feed, in turn, into the calculation of the reward prediction error signal, so there's really no mystery about why you should get these inferred value signals at the level of dopamine under this model. I talked before about the two-step task, which gives you a way of operationalizing model-based versus model-free behavior. Incidentally, the aficionados here will know that there's a little bit of controversy about the interpretation of these two patterns. And anybody, I have things to say about that. If anybody's interested in getting into that afterward, I'm happy to talk about it. But for now, we'll stick with the kind of classical story here. And treat this as a model-free pattern, this is a model-based pattern. We see this pattern in animals. When we train our simple recurrent neural network on this task, we get a very clearly model-based pattern, which is kind of neat. We have a system that we're training with what would classically be referred to as a model-free reinforcement learning algorithm. And yet the behavior that we get looks model-based. So one way of summarizing that is we have a model-free reinforcement learning algorithm giving rise to a separate reinforcement learning algorithm, which is model-based. So it's a new perspective on this dual system idea. I'm going to skip this, but again, it's just to indicate that more detailed analyses of the system's behavior based on more detailed analyses of animal behavior continue to show that the system is acting in a way that looks a lot like animals performing this task. Okay, but critically, I said before that this was one of the first paradigms in which model-based reward prediction error signals were detected in the dopamine system in this fMRI data from Nathaniel Daw. And in our model, again, when we look at the reward prediction error signals that are being generated during this task, and we compare them against what would be predicted by a classical model-based system that's essentially doing planning, right? It has a model of the task, and it's saying, I want to get to that second stage state. Let's see, this action leads there, this action leads there. Okay, I'll do this and because that'll get me there. We look at the reward prediction error signals that such a system should generate, and we compare those against the ones we get from our recurrent neural network, and they're essentially identical. So again, model-free reinforcement learning giving rise to what looked like model-based reward prediction error signals, resolving what had looked like a mystery in the literature. Okay. Okay, so I keep saying that we're talking about learning here, but there's a slight problem with that, given the experimental paradigms that I've been talking about, because they're so simple that really all they do is they alternate between two underlying states. So really, you could say, well, the animals in these experiments are the people that are, you know, they're not really learning. They're just doing inference. They're just figuring out from experience which of two familiar states the task is in. Doesn't take away any of the interest of the results I've showed you, but it does lead us to wonder, you know, what if we now test this system that we've built in a situation where it really has to learn, it really has to deal with something that it hasn't experienced exactly in the past? What happens then? And I'm going to illustrate what happens in the context of a very clever task that was introduced by Harry Harlow back in the 1940s. This is the task that was in the very first paper that ever used the expression learning to learn, a phrase that you may have heard used elsewhere. Or maybe you've seen this paper. What happened here? Well, the subjects were two monkeys, and on each trial, the monkey was shown two objects. And it was allowed to pick up one of the objects, either one, and then under the object was a well, and there might be food in that well, or there might not be. And if there was food, the animal was allowed to take the food and enjoy it. Okay, and then a screen came down, and then the same two objects were placed in front of the monkey when the screen came up. They could be in the same positions, or they could be left, right, reversed in a pseudo-random fashion, and the process continued in the original fashion. The animal picked up one object and saw whether it was rewarded or not. Now, the key was that after every six trials, two completely new objects were introduced, objects that were at least assumed to be completely unfamiliar to the animal. And so the animal had to just start over every six trials, trying to figure out which object it wanted to pick up. But another critical point was that there was a consistent rule, which is that for every pair of objects that was presented, there was always one of them was rewarded, regardless of what position it was in, and one that wasn't rewarded across those six trials. So in that situation, what's the right thing to do? Well, if you understand the structure of the task, on the first trial with two new objects, you just have to guess. There's no way you can do better than that. Just pick one up and see what happens. But then, after that, you should be perfect, right? If that object was rewarded, then pick that object from then on, regardless of where it appears. If it wasn't rewarded, then pick the other object and stick with that one for the rest of the six trials. And that's what Harlow saw. Sorry, I'm using the wrong method here. So these curves have to do with what happened during training, but the critical curve here is the red one. On the first trial, with the new object, the animal was at chance, but boom, on trial two, and from there on, it was at or near ceiling. So we simulated this using our recurrent neural network, but we needed a way of presenting unfamiliar novel stimuli. And in order to do that, we changed this to a saccade task. So this is just a simulated computer display. And the actions that were available to the recurrent network were look right or look left. I guess there was a no-op, too, where it could just choose to stay where it is. And so if it saccades to the right target, and that happens to be the rewarded one, then it gets essentially a drop of juice. If it saccades to the wrong one, it doesn't get juice. And every six trials, as in Harlow's experiment, we presented two completely new images. These are sampled from the ImageNet database. So at test, the system is dealing with images that it has never encountered before. And it has to do this one-shot learning, where it looks at one image that it's never seen before, finds out whether it was rewarded or not, and then based on that, it has to decide what to do on the next five trials. We modified the system in order to deal with high-dimensional pixel-based inputs with a convolutional neural network. Some of you will be familiar with that technology. But otherwise, the architecture was exactly the same. And we see exactly the same pattern. So over training, you know, things get better and better, but after a significant amount of experience with the task, the system is essentially, the x-axis is labeled differently here, but it means the same thing. This is random behavior on the first saccade, and then after that, boom. Oh, I forgot to replace this task. We did some initial experiments with the longer blocks, but when you train it with six-step blocks, it's exactly the same thing. So the network is seeing a picture it's never seen before, finding out whether that picture is good or bad, and then adjusting its behavior after that, which is genuine learning. But it's learning that leverages experience with the same task structure, right? Learning to learn. And remember, this is all happening in the activation dynamics of the system. The synaptic weights are frozen. Okay, so we're almost out of time. I'm gonna skip this section. We can come back to it in discussion if people are curious. It has to do with recent studies in which optogenetics have been used to manipulate dopaminergic release, and we're able to address those findings in a way that I can describe during discussion if we want to come back to it. Okay, but let me summarize. Because we have some time for discussion, is that right? Yeah, okay, good. So we started with reinforcement learning in general. How does the brain learn from reward and punishment? We talked about this now standard theory, whereby dopamine release signals a reward prediction error, and that in turn drives synaptic change in the striatum in connectivity with the prefrontal cortex, which stamps in stimulus-reward associations. We also talked about some awkward findings for that theory, some of which have been dealt with by the idea that there are dual systems, there's a model-based and a model-free system, but there are also some awkward things that arise in experimental work for that theory. But we've managed to kind of put things back together and provide a broader perspective through this thing that we're calling meta-reinforcement learning. So again, there are these three key requirements. In order for all this to happen, it has to be the case that you have a prefrontal cortex network that has recurrent dynamics. So it integrates past rewards and observations. The second assumption, again, was essentially this standard theory of dopamine, whereby there's a dopamine-based reinforcement learning algorithm that uses the reward prediction error to adjust weights in the prefrontal network. And then a third critical assumption is that life is not one reinforcement learning problem, but actually a whole series of them that share structure. This multi-environment assumption. But as long as these three assumptions are met, then emergently, essentially automatically, with no further assumptions, no further innovation, we get this thing that we're calling meta-reinforcement learning, which is involves an emergent learned reinforcement learning algorithm that's implemented in the prefrontal cortex network activity dynamics. And it exploits correlations or task structure in order to learn quickly. Okay, I'm looking forward to discussing this with everyone, but I'll leave it there with a thank you to my collaborators on this project. Thanks.